show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Davis comes to the plate. Strike three called. It's over. They've done it. The Royals are World Series champions. The world champion Kansas City Royals.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome into the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn, a Baseball Prospectus affiliate. Folks, we got more things to talk about, okay? It has been only a week since we had our last show, and only a week, roughly, or not even a week, since the last trade, before the most recent trade. Now, we've got we kind of discussed some rumors because they were floating around last week, but we will delve into the trade here in a second. But, of course, introductions. I am Jeff Herr. With me, as always, is the bringer of the heat wave himself, Mike. I'm holding you personally responsible for this amazing weather that we have, so thank you for that. How are you doing on this very warm, unseasonably warm January evening?
I think I already lost my powers because it was chilly when I was coming home from work. But yeah, it was like 60 something today.
Yeah,
on January 11th. What is that?
I looked at my phone and saw that my weather app said that it was 65 degrees. I was like, man, I got to get outside, take like just a quick walk to my car or something just to get out and feel it. And it was totally awesome.
See, but I didn't get to do that. I didn't even think to do that. I should have. Total missed opportunity.
Yeah, but now those days are gone.
Yeah, we're going to be iced in this weekend.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm supposed to go to this, you know, small that you may have heard of,
tiny
the Kansas
contest.
City Chiefs. They're a football team that they play here in town also. Actually, right across the parking lot from the Royals, if you can believe it.
Like the hotel?
Like the actually. It's next to the hotel. It's called Arrowhead Stadium. Arrowhead.
Never heard of it.
Yeah, weird. No. But so they're playing playoff game on Sunday. I'm supposed to go. I mean, I'm still planning on it right now, but I don't know if Ice McGetty.
You might want to leave now.
Exactly, yeah. I sure hope, you know, we've had some ice storms, but I don't know if in 2002, I mean, we had just this awful one, and I don't know that if it was the same. I don't think that it
2002?
Was.
2002, I don't know. I don't remember.
This was like shut the city down for 2 to 3 entire days. We did not have power for 2 weeks at my house. I remember.
Wow. Holy crap.
Yeah. I mean, you could go outside the night of this ice storm, and you could see – it was like a war movie, you know, like Saving Private Ryan, where they're running across the ridge and you see the explosions. And there's all the transformers blowing up because they're frozen, right? So everyone – nobody has power. And I remember I couldn't type up one of my essays I had to write for my English class because I couldn't – I didn't have power. And I was like, hey, sorry, you know, I have this essay. I have everything I want to do, but I don't have it typed out. You know, I don't have any power to run my computer. And she's like, well, you should have figured something else out. I'm like, gee, thanks for nothing.
Thanks.
I'm freezing my ass off trying to just get sleep under 17 different covers. You're telling me I should go find a typewriter. So
see, anyway. If you'd had a notebook, it wouldn't have been a problem.
Hey, there we go.
So
there we go.
Though I don't know what light you would have used. I guess you could have written in the day. I don't know.
Yeah, I think, let's see, what did I have? I had something. I had like one of those big, you know, heavy duty flashlights that you could post up somewhere and it could get some light. And then the phones worked because, you know, at the time, this is back in the day, okay, not cell phones, but with not even cordless phones. You know, I still had corded phones. That was the one phone I had in my room. So the corded phone that I had did not operate on power. You know, you just plug
it
in.
It's just
and phone. So the phone lines were still good, so I still had my phone available to me, so that was cool. I could like call my friends or something and be like, hey, are you snowed in? Yeah, me too. This
me too. It's really cold. Yep.
This is, yeah, that's the extent of the conversation you have when you're about 17.
I don't remember making phone calls. It's just doesn't happen.
That was you. You were 17 before. That was before phones were invented. Hey-o.
Kids had cell phones in high school. I didn't get a cell phone until I was 20 or something.
I was 16. The only reason I got a cell phone is because my sisters paved the way on that one. And when they finally got a cell phone, my parents realized, okay, this is actually a valuable thing because, hey, we can call them, and if they don't answer, you're in trouble. That was kind of the understood consequence, if you will, of having a phone. If parents call and you don't answer, then you're in trouble. But also then, you know, we could call them if we needed to and everything. And this was when they were kind of starting to phase out cell phones. I remember pay phones. I remember so often getting when I was a little bit younger and my sisters were old enough to like go out to the movies and stuff, and then I get a phone call, you know, 10 o'clock, whatever, and it'd be like, "Would you like to accept a collect call from, hey, Jeff, tell mom and dad to come pick us up," and then hang up.
That's like the commercial.
Exactly. Bob, we out of baby eats a boy.
Perfect.
And
speaking of
having a child, before we get into the show, a big baseball vault congratulations to Hunter Samuels, who has entered the ranks of fatherhood today. His daughter Bryn was born earlier today. I left right after he sent the note that she was born. I didn't get much other information on. Did he provide more? I can pull it up here, but
not really. I mean, left. We just basically told them congratulations. And
yeah, I got my congrats in there, but then I had to leave and go pick my daughter up. So I didn't know if he had if he'd give any more information, but it doesn't appear that way. So anyway.
The mom seems to be doing well, and so real happy for him.
Congrats.
Really cool.
To him. Indeed. So now as we move into royal stuff.
Now we can talk about baseball.
Now we can talk back to baseball, if you would.
We never even started with baseball this time.
That's true. Just in the
baseball
euphemistic sense, back to baseball. But so yes. we discussed last week the possibility. And for a while now, really, because these rumors have been floating. They pick up steam and then they tail off, and they pick up steam. And we're talking about a Jerod Dyson trade. So the idea, you know, trading Jerod Dyson has been bandied about by whoever, you know, to the A's, possibly to, you know, different organizations. Who's he going to, you know, who needs a center fielder? Is he good enough to play every day? What kind of return could we get? You know, since even before the winter meetings, and there was even a little bit at the trade deadline last year about the possibility of him being traded, and nothing ever came of it. And, you know, we had the stance that, you know, still do, I think, on this show, that Jerod Dyson shouldn't be traded, if for no other reason than he's probably more valuable to the Royals than he is to any other organization. Not that he doesn't provide value to them, but, you know, some people just fit the way a team is built better. Some people just fit, you know, organizationally better. And Jerod Dyson was that guy for the Royals. So unfortunately, his time as that guy has come to an end. Jerod Dyson was traded to the Seattle Mariners for Nathan Carnes. Nate, I believe, is what he goes by, which is the name of my cat. So good for him.
Okay.
just a little tidbit there, but a little inside baseball. Mike and I were talking about cats right before we started recording. So that's why it was fresh on my mind. But anyway, Nate Carnes is a 29-year-old pitcher. He's not a spring chicken by any means. He's had pitched 265 total innings in the majors, and he's pitched for the Nationals, the Rays, and the Mariners. Had one decent season, and that's pretty much it. He's got some positive aspects about him that we will get into in a second. But first, Jerod Dyson. No longer a Royal. Mr. Zumbaya has zoomed by Kansas City for the last time, except when, you know, he comes back to play against the Royals.
Yeah.
But so, you know, my first impression is obviously I like Jerod Dyson both as a player and as a person. He seems like a really fun guy. Hate to lose a player like that. We've talked before about how much value he provides, not only in just, you know, the last, you know, year or so, proving that he does have a future as an everyday player in the major leagues, whereas, you know, I think in that 2012-2013 range, we thought he'd be valuable, but didn't quite know if he was that everyday player type of guy. But I think he's proven that he can be. You know, how successful he can be in that range is still up for debate, I think, because he's never had, you know, a full season where he's played every single day. But, you know, he's proven that he belongs, which in that everyday conversation, and not just a bench fourth outfielder guy. You know, he's elite level fourth outfielder, if there is such a thing. Yeah. But as far as a starter, you know, he's just proved that he can be a starter. But beyond that, you know, the clubhouse presence, I think, was huge, you know, and I noticed it when we had the 42 premiere here in Kansas City, you know, that that Bob Kendrick and the Negro League Baseball Museum put together. That was got Harrison Ford and Chadwick Boseman and everything all in town and everything. And that was really cool. But all the Royals players showed up, and that was, I mean, this is 2013?
I think it was 2014.
Was it 2014, really? It was before, it was like this time of year. Let's see. Let's look up.
I mostly just remember that I walked past Jeremy Guthrie on the way to my bathroom, or on the way to the bathroom. And that was around the time he was there.
42 movie came out in 2013.
Okay.
So came out slightly before the season in 2013. But anyway,
good deal.
That was the first time I really noticed the quote unquote power of Jerrod Dyson, if you will. You know, he was kind of like the godfather almost in that scenario there, because, you know, all those guys, Hosmer, Moustakas, Kane, you know, this is before they all kind of, you know, they all had the hype and everything, you know, Kane not so much, but and Haas had his, you know, rookie of the year finalist and all that kind of stuff, but he hadn't truly broken out yet. No playoffs, no World Series, none of that. So, but Jerrod Dyson seemed like he was kind of the leader, and I was like, huh, that seems a little odd. You know, you would naturally think that someone like Eric Hosmer would be the guy that everyone gravitates around and that kind of, you know, leads the group, if you will. But it was, you could see, you know, Jerrod Dyson was kind of that guy. They all obviously had a lot of respect for him. They all liked him, and they all seemed to have fun together and everything. And it's been evidenced by many things since, including up to and including the family style portraits that they all took dressed in full denim.
Classic. So
that's exactly, just really fun stuff that, you know, not every team does that, you know, and has guys that are close friends do weird family type photo shoots wearing all denim. That doesn't happen in every
We're city. Not doing that. So
no, we are certainly not doing
not
it.
Not happening.
We've had some pictures before in our podcasting cruise.
No one wants full denim from podcasters.
No one wants full denim from Mike and myself. I mean, I guess if you really want to, we can discuss it. But I don't think you being the fans, if you guys did give us enough feedback, we'll consider it. But until that day comes,
yeah,
don't plan on it.
Right.
Now, so that's kind of the off-the-field stuff. And then the on-the-field stuff, obviously, again, you know, elite-level fourth outfielder, because, you know, not only can you put him in and start for a week, 10 games in a pinch if you need to, or even longer than that, not only can you bring him in as a defensive replacement late in games, you know, not only can he bat leadoff for you and do decently well at it, but then, you know, as a pinch runner, he comes in and he is an elite weapon as a pinch runner. So I mean, he's very versatile in terms of what he can do. We've always thought that, you know, and you know, once you feel like the scope of a player like Jerrod Dyson is, you know, when he starts to come on and he starts to being utilized correctly by the Royals, it's like, oh man, he's underrated. He's just the most underrated player in the league. He's so valuable. And then it kind of flips, and then it becomes like, oh, he's overrated. He can't be an everyday player. He's not that great. People are overselling it. You know, he doesn't really change that much in terms of his skill set. You know, he's definitely improved on the defense, and his, I don't know that his arm has gotten stronger so much as he's had more opportunities to showcase it. Because I know that you and I remember talked a couple of years ago about how we didn't think his arm was that strong compared to Lorenzo Cain, but I think he debunked that multiple times.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, his arm from an outfielder standpoint is very comparable to, you know, like a Lorenzo Cain, a very, you know, above average arm for an outfielder. So, you know, he's got all those things working for him. Thought it was great. And, you know, it sucks to lose him. So that was kind of my feeling on everything once I heard the news. So once it came down for you, I mean, what? Tell me your process. Go through the five stages of grief for me.
Well, it's funny because, like, it's Gerard Dyson who has pretty much been a role player the whole time. But at the same time, you know, he was drafted in 2006. It was that draft that, you know, just after the Dayton Moore and Allard Bear transition. And technically, he wasn't even a Dayton Moore pick because Dayton Moore was, wink, wink, abstaining from that draft. You know, as kind of a condition of Atlanta letting him go. And so when you think about that, Dyson's pretty much been in the league on the Royals longer than, like, Dayton Moore. It's kind of weird to think of it that way. And he was a 50th round pick. And so I just remember in 2010 when he came up, it was pretty exciting. And one of the first kind of things that I kind of remember about him was, well, okay, that guy could probably play center field. And then I thought about it a little more. I'm like, I don't know if he'd be a full-time guy. And then, you know, so that was kind of my first. It was like just thinking back to how long he's actually been around and how long it took him to get to the big leagues and what he's done since. And then I thought about all the kind of the big moments that he's been a part of. You know, I remember there's a game, I think it was 2013, where it was against the Twins, bottom of the eighth, tie game. He's on third. Alcides Escobar hits a little jam shot blooper to short, and Dyson scores on it. And I think that's what Speed Dude came from. He was the guy that they talked to in the post game, and he said, that's what Speed Dude. And then I remember, you know, in 2014 when the Royals beat, who'd they beat? They beat Detroit? No, they beat Oakland, Tampa, crap, I forget the game, but it was a game where they took over first place briefly in August, right? It was in the same period that Sungwoo was in town, so it was awesome, like, 2-week period of Royals baseball. They win the game and he does a backflip in the outfield.
Yes,
later
the
on
gift that shall live forever. One of many from him.
Fantastic. Then, you know, the wild card game, he steals third against Oakland, does the rev it up dance, and then scores to tie, and then, you know, just so many of those kind of moments. And then in 2015, you know, another big kind of moment that I remember is when Alex Gordon went down in that game against Tampa, you know, with the torn groin, and Dyson filled in for him. And not only did Dyson make a great play in the outfield shortly after, I think he threw a guy out at home trying to tag up. Later on, he hits an inside the park homer, and so Kauffman Stadium went from like this funeral parlor, kind of just silent, nervous energy, to just completely picked up. And you know, he was that kind of exciting player. And you know, I kind of feel like my reaction to him being traded was more disappointed than when Wade Davis was traded, because there's all these different moments, and Davis, you know, huge guy,
he was so stoic.
Yeah But Dyson was always the guy. You know, remember what he said to Baltimore, you know, in the ALCS? They asked him, do you think you're going to become a backer? He's like, no sir, I don't, and I don't think they think so either. And it was going to be bulletin board material and stuff, and the Royals ended up winning that series anyway. And that was his role. He was the mouthpiece, he was the talker for these guys. And so you can see why he was, you know, so popular with guys in the clubhouse. And that's kind of the stuff that I think of, because, you know, huge personality for kind of a bit player. So it's tough to see him go, but, you know, it's also one of those things. He's probably not going to get extended, so he's probably going to be going one way or the other. But yeah, I mean, I've kind of felt like, you know, it's a bummer to kind of lose those guys. It's also kind of a reminder, or even a kind of a, I guess, an opening shot to prepare for the other guys to start to leave, because they're not going to be able to extend all the guys who are free agents, and they're probably not going to try to extend them all. And so, you know, you're going to go through a lot of these kind of things with Moustakas and Hosmer and Kane and potentially Danny Duffy and whomever else is out there. And so it, you know, it's kind of one of those things where, okay, we can see how we, you know, fans react to Dyson, and kind of go from there. And another, you know, one thing that you said on Twitter that day was like, you know, they might get back to the championship. They might win another one, but it's not going to be the same as the group from 2015, who I think, you know, for people probably closer to your age, I still remember enough about like the post 85 World Series group, mm-hmm. you know, because, you know, Frank White was still playing when I started watching baseball all the time,
right.
and Willie Wilson and George Brett. But like for people probably just a little bit younger than me, you know, this is that group. You know, this is the Brett, Wilson, McRae, Saberhagen, et cetera type mm-hmm. of group. And so if Dyson's leaving, it's like you have to be ready for that group to kind of disperse. And, you know, so that makes it kind of difficult. I think that's why the reaction by so many fans was so strong for Dyson, because it was like real strong disappointment and a real kind of batch of memories that people, you know, were sharing on Twitter and Facebook and everywhere else. So it's pretty interesting to see that reaction for a fourth outfielder. But, you know, like you said, I mean, he's someone who can probably handle more of a full-time role, but I don't think that was going to happen with the Royals the way that they're set up now. And, you know, if he was going to be a free agent, he was going to be looking for that kind of opportunity anyway. And mm-hmm. it probably wasn't going to be coming in Kansas City with you know, the way they're set up at the moment. So probably the best thing for him, and the Royals get an intriguing pitcher in return. And not only just intriguing, but they get, you know, Carnes is not even arbitration eligible yet. It's kind of weird when he's 29 and hasn't hit arbitration yet, but
a little bit,
he's going to make just a bit over the league minimum this year. And so that makes him, you know, the Royals, even in trading Dyson, who's estimated to be like $2.5 million in arbitration, they still save money. And they kind of get a player who's going to be around for, oh, potentially four seasons with them. So it's kind of, it's similar to the Davis and Soler trade in that they traded a guy who was going to give you 1 year of production and got a guy who has, you know, probably 4 years of production. As long as these guys, you know, stay healthy and productive, the Royals will keep tendering contracts to them. So in that sense, logically, it makes sense. But, you know, as a fan, it does kind of suck to see these guys walk away.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it I do believe that there is that kind of, and I don't know how much Wade Davis was part of it, because, you know, he came over in the Shields Myers trade, and, you know, that was 2013. Whereas, you know, with Dyson, like you mentioned, being drafted in 06, so he was already here when Moustakas was drafted, when Eric Hosmer was drafted, when Danny Duffy was drafted, all those guys, you know. So he was kind of part of that maturation process for this crew in the minors all the way through. So, you know, there's that camaraderie that, I mean, that's a rare thing in baseball, you know, to have such a tight group of players. And so, you know, it's a, excuse me, that's something that, you know, basically the, you know, team like the Royals has to do. But when you look at, you know, say you look at some of those Boston teams, right? Like, say you look at the 2004 Boston team, right? You know, Manny Ramirez didn't play minor league baseball in Boston's organization. You know, David Ortiz didn't either, you know, and they didn't play together. They didn't come up. Johnny Damon, they didn't, you know, Curt Schilling, all those guys, none of them kind of came up together. They were just assembled as, hey, you guys are a group of really good players, let's go win this thing. And they did. There's nothing wrong with that either, you know, but there is a more business-like feel to something like that. I mean, I'm not a player, so I don't, this is just the outside, you know, the way I perceive it, the way I feel, like the way how, you know, it looks to me when I see things like that, you know. So
they're hired guns, they're mercenaries, absolutely. They're being, again, assembled, they're not being developed.
Absolutely. That's a perfect way to put it. There's nothing wrong with that. I would absolutely love it 100% if it won me 3 World Series.
Right. So I would not complain.
This is not a disparaging one method or the other, just simply trying to illustrate a difference. So, you know, there's a bit of a kind of bittersweet feeling when part of that crew goes away. And I think this is, again, Wade Davis kind of came on, and he kind of does have that hired gun feeling of, okay, we got this course established, now we're bringing in you to help put us over the hump. And he did. And that's great.
Mm-hmm.
And, but, you know, Dyson is the first piece of, as you mentioned, of that kind of core leaving, and maybe the, as you said, the first of many to come, you know, at the end of, at the latest, at the end of the 2017 season. And should 2017 get off the rails in terms of losing games, then who knows, it could be sooner, hopefully not, but, you know, the possibility is there. So that's kind of, it'll be interesting to see how the players react. You know, we had Leskie was giving us the lowdown on Lorenzo Cain was on MLB radio earlier today, and he was kind of talking about it, and he mentioned that, you know, he more or less kind of thought that their his mindset, his being Lorenzo Cain's mindset, was that, hey, we're gonna, you know, we're keeping Wade Davis, keeping Jerod Dyson, keeping as much of the crew together as we possibly can. We're moving forward. We're gonna do this thing. We're gonna give one last shot at it in 2017. You know, because players aren't stupid. You know, they know what's going down as well. You know, they know a lot of them aren't going to be back, and this is probably their last chance. So, you know, they're treating it as such, as appropriate. And now, you know, Jerod Dyson being gone, you know, Wade Davis being gone, and Lorenzo Cain expressed, like, okay, you know, I didn't necessarily anticipate. This is me. This is not direct quotes. This is me just summarizing what he said via, you know, what the information that we got. So it's kind of interesting, but, you know, more or less, also, you know, Cain then did add, hey, you know, it's a business. We know how it goes. We got a player in return for Dyson, so we're going to take Nate Carr. We got a player in return for Wade Davis. We're taking all these pieces, you know, Jorge Soler, Nate Carnes, all this. We're putting them all together, and we're still going to make another run at this thing. So, you know, it's not – and I assumed that, you know, for me, I thought the difference was going to be – in the fact that, you know, the Royals have kind of matured to this point. Not that they were immature before, but, you know, there's just still a maturation process where you say, okay, the 2012-2013 Royals, you know, if you would have traded Jerod Dyson away, Eric Hosmer probably would have been pretty pissed and wouldn't have been yeah. very happy about it, you know, because those two, just from kind of the stories you hear and everything, they might be the closest. And, you know, so that whole crew, you know, might have been – you know, very upset about it. And then does that affect the play? Does that affect how they view the Royals? All that kind of stuff. You know, who knows? We didn't have to find out, thankfully. You know, but now they've been to multiple playoff runs, multiple World Series. They've won the awards. They've done all, you know, they've grown up in the business, if you will. So I think there's an understanding of, you know, okay, we get it. Jerod Dyson's gone. That's okay. Let's do this. You know, we can still make a run at this thing, and they can handle it better now. So, you know, I don't know that there was any clamoring for teams to get Jerod Dyson a few years ago, like maybe there were now, but it's better that they did it now, in my opinion, just because I think if there is an impact, a locker room impact, if you will, from losing Jerod Dyson, I think it's lessened by the fact that the players are quite a bit more experienced in the business of the game now. And it you know, they're more equipped to overcome it personally. That's, you know, for whatever effect mm-hmm. that has. That's just kind of how I've viewed doing it now versus maybe a couple of years ago, if it was even an option.
Yeah. One thing that Sam Mellinger wrote, and I think it was his Mellinger minutes, was like someone asked about the kind of clubhouse impact that this trade might have. And he brought up the point that, like, if these guys who are, you know, they're now in their late 20s, if they can't handle one of their teammates, you know, getting traded, how the heck did they win a World Series? You know, if they can't, if they're so easily shaken, how did they get through all of those playoff runs? And, you know, I think that, you think about guys like Eric Hosmer, this is going to be basically his seventh year in the league. It still kind of feels like they're really young and they've only just come up in a way, but they've been around a while and they kind of, you know, obviously they have to understand the business. I mean, at this stage, guys like Hosmer and Moustakas have probably been talking about their post Kansas City potential with at least their agent to a point. And Cain's talked to the Royals about, you know, contract extension, last off season. And they didn't really offer one, you know, they didn't offer at least the one that he wanted. And so it's kind of like you see where they have to face the reality of it. And so I agree. I don't think there's going to be that big of an impact as far as, like, you know, maybe they open the season and it's not quite the same, but I don't think it's going to be something where, like, any of these players are going to be shaken to the point that it really affects their job, because they're just past that. So I think it's going to be one of those things. There's plenty of leaders left in that locker room. You've got Eric Hosmer is going to be the face. Sal Perez is that kind of, I guess, the heart of the team. Moustakas has always been touted for having some leadership qualities, and behind the scenes, quietly working, 24/7 is Alex Gordon setting the example. And that's not to mention guys who might step up and kind of exhibit some of that leadership potential as well. You know, they're going to be fine. It's going to come down to how do they play on the field, which, that's going to determine a lot more. And not having Dyson does hurt, but the Royals are at least kind of tempered. Like last week when we were talking about Pete O'Brien and getting him, and I kind of came up with the back of the napkin, first glance lineup. Mm-hmm. I was just jotting down some of the I put him in the lineup, and then I thought about, well, what kind of attributes, what are their main attributes for that? And so, like, Escobar is a contact guy with some speed. Moustakas is a contact guy who has some power. Lorenzo Cain is pretty balanced all over the place. Hosmer can make contact but has occasional power. Sal Perez is good power for a catcher. Alex Gordon has good plate patience, has occasional power. Jorge Soler has great power, really good patience. Pete O'Brien is a power guy. And then it gets down to, like, the guys like Raul Mondesi, Whit Merrifield, Paulo Orlando. Those guys are all speed guys. And Dyson was a speed guy and not an extreme contact guy, not an extreme walk guy. He was pretty okay with the bat, had a career year last year, as far as batting average and on base, and, you know, looked pretty good and played great defense. And back to an earlier point, his defense has improved quite a lot. I remember in 2012, I did not like his defense at all. And he's forced me to reassess, his abilities defensively, and he's much better. And I think he's much better at picking out the routes and not just relying on his speed. But, you know, losing Dyson, you still have a lot of speed out there. Orlando can be a pretty good center fielder. You've got enough guys who can probably steal those kind of bases. Mondesi can steal any base he wants. Terrence Gore is still on the 40-man roster. He can be that pinch run guy if they want to use him that way. Orlando has a lot of speed. Maybe not as good of a base stealer, but he's got a ton of speed. And Whit Merrifield's got a lot of speed as well. So, you know, they're not going to be hurting in that kind of category. And so losing Dyson, it's a little bit replaceable. I also kind of think that Dyson, he could probably handle a full-time role, I think he's still better suited as a part-time role. I think the way the Royals have used him the past couple seasons is pretty ideal for him. You know,
it's damn near perfect, honestly.
You don't expose him. If you need to use him for a couple weeks to cover a DL stint, you can definitely do that, even if he's starting for a month. But I don't know where it is, but there's got to be a cutoff where, you know, diminishing returns on his plate appearances. It might be 400 plate appearances, might be 450. I don't know. He'll walk plenty. He'll hit well. The Mariners are going to play him in left field, apparently, which seems odd. I would think they would put him in center, but, that's okay. Whatever they want to do. He can play left field. I mean, and as we've discussed, he certainly has the arm for it. I think he should be able to have a pretty good season, but I think if the Mariners are expecting him to go out and give them 700 plate appearances and be the same guy he was last year with, pretty good contact, good walk rate, things like that, I don't know that he could do it over a full season. It's not as simple as saying, well, let's double his plate appearances and double the rest of the stats. It just doesn't always work that way. But I think he can still be really productive for them. It is the Royals are going to kind of have to piecemeal it together, because Terrence Gore can't do the things that Dyson could do with the bat and not really with the glove either. And like I said, Orlando isn't the base stealer. that Dyson was, but can probably handle the bat about as well and can probably handle at least center field just about as well if he needs to. So, you know, the Royals can pretty much make it up, but they probably have to use a bunch of guys to kind of make it work. So that's another kind of roster impact that they'll face by losing Dyson.
Yeah, and, you know, it's we've kind of said all there is to say, I think, at least in that point of losing Dyson. It's unfortunate, you know, not only from an on-the-field perspective, as you mentioned, it's, you know, it, the Royals, that's one of the things that the Royals have, you know, they kind of took a lot of flack for in the beginning, if you will, of this run, kind of in that 2010, 11, 12 range of the way they utilized players. But I do think they learned from it. I do think they grew, both the players and the coaching staff, and they really learned how to utilize the players to the best of their ability, you know, starting with the bullpen, but extending to players like Jerod Dyson and players like Terrence Gore in the playoffs and such. So, you know, that was part of Dyson's success. Make no mistake. The Royals utilized him 100% appropriately, and that helped him to reach the levels of success that he did. So, you know, the Royals do get some credit for that. So hopefully, though, they can use his replacement, his return in the trade appropriately. Nate Karns, we discussed at the beginning of this discussion, the topic a little bit about him. But, you know, as we mentioned, they had, you know, he's pitched for the Nationals, Rays, and Mariners. The bulk of the innings that he has pitched are with the Rays, 159 innings with them. Best season is the season that he had the most time played, which was 2015, 147 innings pitched at a 3.67 ERA. For the Rays, you know, it's not an easy division there. You know, it's a tough place to play, or a tough division to play in. A lot of small parks, a lot of big hitters, Toronto, Baltimore, New York, Boston, the whole deal. But, you know, he had a pretty good season there. Last year with the Mariners, 94.1 innings pitched. Not so much of a good season, 5.15 ERA. But, you know, there's some bright spots. He had a 9.64 strikeout per nine, K per nine ratio. But contrast that with the 4.29 walk per nine inning walk rate. So his home run rate was the lowest that it had been in his career, but he had an incredibly high walk rate. He gave up a 327 BABIP, and his things weren't all that great. So, you know, when you look, you see, you know, for however much value you want to put in something like a FIP score, you know, it was 4.09 during his really good season in 2015 and 4.05 in 2016. So, in a lot of the metrics, a lot of the things, you know, which that's just trying, you know, however flawed that statistic might be, that's what it's trying to do, is kind of just strip away all the noise and say of what a pitcher can control, what are they really doing well, and or how well are they really doing, I should say. And so that shows that, you know, even with some of the noise factored out, he did similarly to how he did in 2015. So, and how that portends to his future will remain to be seen. But we had, there was an article, let's see.
Are you thinking of the FanGraphs one?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. The,
about the spin rates?
About spin rates and how his fastball wasn't the same last year, which got some of us talking about, you know, you had some back issues last year, and you could definitely see how a back issue for a major league pitcher could mess with his release point, mess with the way that the ball comes out of his hand, and thus how the spin rate may diminish. You know, he had kind of a rise on his fastball, that article explained. It was an article by Eno Saris, I believe, wrote it. And so, you know, we've talked before, and a lot of people have talked and written about, like, Chris Young, and how his fastball is perceived to be a rising fastball, and how that gives it a different look. And Karns is kind of in the same way. And so if last year he wasn't having that same kind of effect on his fastball, you can imagine that he's going to get hit a little bit, that, you know, he's going to give up more runs. He's not going to pitch as well. And he didn't. And so, you know, if that's something that the Royals are thinking about and that they have noticed that, okay, here is where we might make this and that tweak, Dave Island's been really good at kind of picking those things out and getting results from pitchers who otherwise you wouldn't kind of expect them to kind of have the production that they've had. So that it seems like the Royals are kind of banking on that kind of a thing to work out, that they see something, they think they can fix it, and Dave Island's going to work with them to make sure that it works out. And, you know, if he's healthier when he comes to spring training, that'll certainly help too. So, you know, I don't know if there's anything else in that article. Like, I kind of skimmed it. Cause
yeah, I mean, I think that pretty much sums it up.
Spin rate's kind of like, at a certain point, I'm like, not 100% sure I understand every part of this. But
yeah, spin rate's definitely one of those nebulous areas where it's like,
I just need more time to sit down and really look and compare things. But
I don't even know how they quantify it. How do they even, you know, I just kind of take it. I know, because sometimes when
I think the pitch really effects cameras can pick it up.
Can they really? That's impressive. Because sometimes with a lot of that stuff, when it gets really complex, I can strip away everything from the and just say, okay, however they do it, I at least can understand its comparative value. You know, like, okay, if someone has X spin rate on a curveball and another pitcher has X spin rate on a curveball, it's like, okay, I know that this is better. So. Right. Yeah, I can see it that
way. Right. It's kind of like
all the rest of the stuff.
It's kind of like wins above replacement or quarterback rating, where you don't necessarily need to know every ingredient in the soup. You just know what it means, what it's trying to tell you. You know, as long as you have that concept in your mind, you don't have to know every single component. But if you do know those, then you can kind of maybe narrow down as to why there's a fluctuation.
And as a slight tangent, you know, that's why some of the defensive metrics aren't as valuable, because a lot of those, the comparative values there are subjective based, you know, when it comes to like zone ratings and different things like that. You know, was a ball in a certain zone or not? Was it alive? Was it a line drive? Was it this? Was it that? You know, those things are actually, you know, up to the person making that determination at the time. Whereas, you know, spin rate developed by a computer through a camera, you know, that's something that is a little bit more, you have more confidence in the consistency of that data.
Yep. Another wrinkle on that is that, like, when you're talking about like fly ball versus line drive, the height of the press box can change a determination. You could have the same hit and someone who's maybe a level up in a press box may call it differently just because the angle that they read is different. So
That'd be interesting if you had access to it, if you could see, you know, I'm thinking access to like who makes the determinations, but, you know, I wonder if you could go through by each ballpark and say, see if, you know, the determination, the line drive rates are lesser. It's like, it's so hard to tell. It's like, is that, you know, what factors would cause a lesser line drive rate? But that'd be kind of interesting to look into if it was even a feasible way to do it.
It's just,
because that's a very good point.
At least it's something to keep in the back of your mind as far as, like, you know, there's as like anything, context is important, and keep the context in mind. But what are we talking about? Spin rate, Nate
spin
Karns,
rates, Nate
Karns, fastball
injuries.
Okay,
come into spring training healthy.
All right, I'm centered again.
Okay.
But the one thing that he does have is have a really good curveball. And the our pals over at Royals Review, they talked to one of the guys from Lookout Landing, which is the SB Nation Mariners site. And so they got to see Nate Karns last year. And they said that the curveball is like one of the best pitches they've seen. Like, just, you know, on anybody on the team, and that includes Felix Hernandez. So it's like, okay, that's intriguing. So you can kind of see how a good fastball in 2015 with a really good curveball could come up with really good results. And if the fastball's not as good, maybe the curveball's not as good, or maybe the difference isn't as good. in 2016. And so, you know, then it kind of points to, well, there's your opportunity. That's the opportunity you might find to get some improvement out of him and see if he can be someone productive. There's also, and I'm not the first one to kind of make this observation or even comparison, but, you know, he's a high strikeout pitcher. He's got good velocity. You know, he can work in the mid-90s. So good velocity, good curveball, but sometimes has trouble throwing strikes, sometimes has trouble getting through more than five innings, can strike guys out. Sound familiar to anybody that we've covered on the Royals in the past couple of years? Sounds a little bit like Danny Duffy.
Wouldn't you know? And, you know, physically, he kind of looks like him in the face a little bit. In some of the pictures I've seen, it's kind of weird. That was my thought. I guess I shouldn't say physically because he's a bigger guy, but in the face.
Yeah.
And, to me. And, I don't know if you share that thought, but when I saw a picture, I was like, I could see some Duffbro comparisons there.
So I kind of just glanced at it, and the comparisons, it's flimsy. It's more of a profile than the numbers. Like, oh, look, it's exactly the same. Duffy from 2011 to 2014 walked about four guys per nine innings. That's around the same. I think it's 3.8 for Carnes. But Duffy, you know, he didn't really get the strikeouts until last year. And it was just a little bit more hitting the spots, hitting the plate, you know, a little more on his stuff. Just small adjustments that kind of made it work. But Carnes has always been a strikeout guy. He's always been a high strikeout kind of player. And, you know, to me, it seems like you can find more tweaks to make somebody have better control and better control of the strike zone to not walk guys. It seems easier to do that than to teach them how to blow the ball past somebody. You know, it's hard to teach a 9+ K per nine. That's tough.
Right. Yep.
You know, there's only so many people who can do that. So if you have someone who can do that, maybe you can teach them to, you know, throw more strikes, be more consistent with it. And if he's not walking as many people, he's not throwing as many pitches, he's probably getting deeper into games. And maybe that makes him more of a productive guy. You know, just looking at his time through the order, compared to the league, and I just went ahead and compared his numbers over his career to last year's American League average. So he does walk a lot. You know, he walked first time through the order, he walked 9.4% of the batters he faced. The second time through the order, he walked 9.2%. Third time through the order, he walked 10.5%. So maybe there's something in his pitch mix. Maybe there's something in fatigue that makes him less likely to hit the zone. The league was 7.5, 7.7, and 7.8 first, second, and third time through. So he's already walking more, and then the extremes in that second to third is much greater than a pretty stable league. There's also a larger sample of pitchers' innings, plate appearances for the walk rate for the American League, obviously. It was like 20-some thousand at-bats, or maybe even more than that, 200-some. I don't know. It was a lot more, obviously. But, you know, his strikeout rate is much greater, deeper into those games, too, because he just has an ability to get strikeouts. So that seems kind of like it takes me back to the parable of the scout who has two guys run down to first, and he measures one guy who looks, let's call him Bubba Starling, looks like the perfect athlete, you know, a gazelle-like stride, and he runs all the way through first and has a great time. And then you have some guy who, let's say, looks like, I don't know, who's a good comparison? Maybe he looks like a pretty average guy, and he runs through, but does just enough and has exactly the same time, but it's a little herky-jerky, it's a little weird. Mm-hmm. Which one do you want? You want the guy whose technique you can improve, who already has the ability to be very fast, and that's kind of the way it is with Carnes. And so I'm thinking that the Royals can get on top of helping him improve his walks. They may have something. They may have a guy who has probably like a number four, number five starter floor, but potentially could be like a number three, maybe even number two if it really, really goes well. kind of a ceiling, and they would have him for relatively cheap compared to other pitchers of his age and at that level. So that's a big point in their favor. It's a big if too.
Right. And as always with the Royals in this regime, you know, when you have a pitcher like Carnes who's got talent, you know, if you can harness it as a starter, obviously remains to be seen.
Yep.
But talent is there. You talked about it. Can't teach certain things. And having a strikeout rate that high is something that you cannot teach. Now, so if he can't cut it as a starter,
yep,
there's a really good shot that he can be a lights-out reliever a la Wade Davis, a la right, Luke Hochaver. So, you know, there's some options here with him that you can kind of fall back on. Now, you know, speaking of that, I think the Royals are going to give him every opportunity to start because, you know, I think they believe that he can.
They think they can, and they don't have a lot of options otherwise.
No, yeah, they don't know. They don't necessarily have a lot of choice. And how much do we believe in the island magic? Can he make it happen? Can he make enough tweaks that Nate Carnes is, you know, even if he has 2015 Chris Young type season, we'd be ecstatic about that. I would.
Yeah.
Now, but with that, I think it's kind of lays out the path for keeping Strom in the bullpen, at least for next season.
Yep.
Would you agree with that assessment there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, the Royals rotation, the top four are basically there. I mean, you've got Duffy, Kennedy, Ventura, and Jason Vargas will be back. And it's just the other, you know, candidates were like Mike Minor or Chris Young or Strom. And, you know, none of those are really great. You know, Strom's probably the most upside, but he's one of the bigger question marks, too. Or I guess maybe not the biggest, but it's, you know, it's definitely unknown. Not someone they want to. Yeah, it's unknown. There are innings limitations that they still want to be, you know, thinking about. And so going and getting Carnes, you know, you can put him in there. And if for 15 starts he's not any good, well, maybe you can flip-flop him. You know, maybe then Strom gets a shot to pitch, or maybe at that point someone else has emerged. Jake Junis is around. Alec Mills is around. Maybe Josh Stamont comes around.
How dare you forget to mention Kyle Zimmer coming off his thoracic outlet syndrome surgery. He's cured, Mike. He's cured.
It's a miracle.
It's a Festivus miracle. He'll be back.
Maybe. We'll see. I have no idea.
I'm obviously being facetious, but...
Just a little bit.
I do. Just a little bit. But I think that's actually... You bring up a really good point because I think that's a perfect way almost to kind of... you know, if you think Strom has a future as a starter and you still want to put him there, but you're worried about the innings limit, then he becomes kind of the Danny Duffy type where, you know, you don't start out the season in the rotation, but you know, you can, if he comes in after 15 starts because Carnes isn't cutting it, then maybe Carnes has a lot of success in the bullpen and Strom can be successful as a starter and you don't lose anything in your bullpen because you replace one successful guy with another. And then maybe you take a step up in your starter, your fifth starter spot. And then if you are making a playoff run, which if you're making that switch, you're most, well, I guess that's not true. There's a good, That switch could go either way. It could go that the Royals are doing really well. Their only weakness is fifth starter, and so they flip-flop those two. Or it could be season's done. Let's have a fire sale, and let's get Strom in here to get him some starting reps. So I guess we'll see how that goes. So But there's a really good chance, you know, if Carnes doesn't succeed, that Strom gets to step into that role. So, and then you kind of artificially control the innings, because I mean you're looking at like 150 innings assuming you were to go make a deep playoff run, if that really, I'm sure, I mean, I guess 15, I mean, yeah, that'd be about right.
Yeah,
so that's you know, that's not unreasonable, I don't think, for Strom, 2 years removed from Tommy John and after, you know, pitching a full season like he did in relief, admittedly, but last year. So, you know, I think that's completely reasonable and allows you to not have to butt up. And I think, I guess I don't know what their innings limit would be. Maybe it would be 150. Maybe it would be 180 or something. So, you know, who knows? But that's kind of an added benefit, if you will, of Nate Carnes is giving giving Strom not only more time to breathe in terms of innings, but then also still, you know, making sure, okay, nobody knew who he was last year, and so he kind of snuck up on people maybe from a bullpen standpoint. But teams know who he is now. They know his deal. They've had an entire offseason to look into what he does. Can he still be as successful? You know, because that's important. Lots of relievers come up and have one really good season and then disappear. Yep. So, you know, can he continue on that road? So you're easing him in not only with less innings, but also in that mold, too, of being able to continue the success that he previously had. And then if he can kind of snowball that into a starting role. So while it sucks to give to lose Dyson, you know, especially for a player like Nate Karns, which is kind of perplexing. But, you know, yeah. it was a need for the Royals. So it's something that, like you said, you know, his floor is a, you know, just a 4-5 starter, but his ceiling is higher than that. So if the Royals can, maybe they saw something, you know, they always, I think when it comes to pitching acquisitions, they talk to Dave Island. So I honestly don't believe this organization takes a pitcher in any format, free agent signing, trading, whatever, without talking with Island first and saying, you know, can he be better here? And, you know, I would assume if they made this trade that Island said, yes, he can. We can make this work and we can, you know, get him back on track. Now, whether or not it actually happens or not is a different story. But, you know, I do think there's, for them to make a move like this, there's got to be a feeling that, okay, we think there's something here that we can utilize better, whether it's because of Kauffman Stadium or whether it's because of tweaks that Island wants to make to his delivery or whatever. You know, something that can be done. So for now, at least, and I think it's because they've earned it, you know, I have the faith the Island magic can turn Nate Karns into a decent pitcher, whether it's a starter or reliever. You know, I think he'll have some value to this team next year. How big or how small and where that value comes, I guess we'll see later. Maybe he's just Peter Moylan, you know, which isn't bad. Moylan was valuable to the team last year, but you know, he wasn't a super important cog in the wheel, so you know, maybe he's just that and it's like, okay, well, you know, whatever. Or you know, maybe he's again 2015 Chris Young, where he's actually a very vital piece of the team's success and actually carries the staff on his back for a couple weeks, you know, or a month. You know, I don't know that that's necessarily going to happen, but you know, maybe that's what occurs. And if so, then it's like, well, you can't really blame them for making the trade. It worked out in their favor.
Yeah. And I think, you know, just looking at who else is out there, like Jason Hamill is a guy that I would have liked the Royals to go get, but you know, he's not much different. Jason Hamill's he's kind of a Jason Vargas, but right-handed, like, and just that, very nondescript. There's nothing that sticks out about Hamill. He's pitched pretty well the last couple of years. That's about all you can say about him. You know, he's probably would have been fine, but he probably also would have been somebody who would have cost, I don't even know, I mean, $5 million on a contract. And the Royals are very careful about what kind of payroll they're adding right now. It seems like this might actually be the year where they say that they're going to handle the payroll and they actually don't go spend more for a change. That they still could, but it seems like, you know, right now the moves that they're making are very shrewd in that they're getting big league caliber guys, but they're getting big league caliber guys with some cost control. And so a free agent starter probably wasn't going to be in the cards, which meant that they were going to be either going with Matt Strom or Chris Young or Mike Minor. And none of those guys, I mean, Strom's probably the guy I would want to see get that shot. But like you said, it's no sure thing. And there may be just as much value in bringing him up as a reliever and then maybe transitioning later if you need to. Or you just leave him in the bullpen and he's a lights-out reliever. You know, either way, I think the Royals would be happy with for at least 2017. So, you know, this gives them some flexibility to kind of avoid lesser options and maybe bring along other guys who probably aren't ready to try to make 30 starts or even cobble together 30 starts among four or five different guys, because that's what they tried last year and that sure didn't work very well. So this gives them a little bit of at least perceived stability. He could come out and be terrible or get hurt or anything like that could happen, certainly. But, you know, right now they pretty much, I got to think, they've got him at least penciled in and probably pretty close to inked in as that number five guy. And then you just kind of see what happens, what your needs are later on in the year. Again, like you said, if they need to move him into the bullpen, you know, he can work 92 to 94 as a starter now. So you put him in the bullpen, you have him just throw fastball, curveball. You know, he probably is going to be throwing 96 routinely out of the bullpen in one and two inning stints. And you know, we've seen that from other guys on the Royals. And you see how those kind of guys can really let it loose, and they usually do better in that kind of a role. Or at least they resurrect some value that way. So that could be a fallback option. And if that's the case, then you've got, you know, three more years of that guy as maybe a back-end bullpen option. So, you know, for pretty cheap. So it's going to be something that ideally, you know, even in that bad scenario where you can't cut it as a starter, he's at least providing value somewhere for, you know, a player that the Royals probably were not going to be retaining past this year. So when I really think about it, while the name value wasn't that great when I first saw the announcement, you know, I think it works out to be a pretty okay trade for the Royals and the kind of things that they want to do this year.
Yeah, and I go back to similar with the Wade Davis trade. You know, if you can't clearly pick out a winner and a loser, then it's probably a good trade. You know, I think we struggle so hard with the trade to immediately say, oh, this team won, this team lost, this is the better deal and all that kind of stuff, not realizing that trades aren't supposed to be that way. Trades aren't supposed to be one team getting ripped off and one team coming out really far ahead. You know, you look at, go back to, you know, we say the Zach Greinke trade, you know, was so huge in the Royals developing into this team and winning the 2015 World Series. And it absolutely was, you know, both 2014 and 2015 ALCS MVPs and Lorenzo Cain and Elcides Escobar from that. But, you know, if you look at it and, you know, the Brewers didn't get a World Series, but they got a trip to the playoffs with Zach Greinke. I think they made the NLCS that year, didn't they?
They won their division. I think they got knocked out in the first or in the division series.
I couldn't remember,
but it wasn't because of Greinke. It was because nobody else hit.
Yeah,
that
and then
mashed all year, and then they get to the playoffs and didn't mash. But Greinke got him into the playoffs.
Yep, and then they took Greinke and they flipped him for was it John Segura and or Gene Segura? Who was it?
Gene Segura and John Helwig was the other.
John Helwig. Yep.
Helwig's somewhere like Arizona now or something, and Segura's bounced to Arizona and to Seattle. So,
you know, but those were good prospects at the time.
Oh, yeah.
And they bounced them for you know, half a season of Zach Greinke. So the Brewers got what they needed out of that deal, and the Royals did too. And then you look at the, you know, James Shields trade, and you know, that
the James Shields trade has been renamed numerous times, so
that's
shows
right.
you how the value is weird in it, because it was the Will Myers trade, and then the James Shields trade when the Royals got into the playoffs, and Myers ended up traded to the Padres from the Rays, and then Wade Davis turns into this cyborg monster, and then it became the Wade Davis trade. So,
yep.
You know,
version 3.0.
Right. It's
so, yeah. I mean, but you got, you know, Will Myers was Rookie of the Year. Jake Odorizzi has turned out really well, yeah. And now, you know, the Royals, obviously, Wade Davis propelled them to a World Series. James Shields propelled them to a World Series. So, you know, I mean, these things, and I think everyone was pretty happy on both sides of those two trades. And those were kind of the mega trades. You know, these are obviously on a much smaller scale, but I think you can see, you know, and I mean, if you're the Mariners, you know, I don't know that the Mariners are super excited about Jerod Dyson. You know, I mean, they're probably seeing all these, you know, Kansas City fans and stuff on Twitter, if they happen to look in after the trade and see all of us kind of being so upset, and maybe they're like, well, hey, maybe we got a better player than we realized.
But big deal.
Yeah, but it's more of just kind of a fan favorite type of a thing than it is any just outlandish skill, even though, you know, obviously the speed is an outlandish skill. But other than that, the overall skill as a player wasn't, you know, super amazing or anything like that. But, you know, he was a much beloved, if you will. So, But I'm sure the Mariners are probably just like, yeah, he seems like a fine player, and he can probably play every day. And they're right. You know, so and we're just like, Nate Karn's like, yeah, he seems like a fine player. He's probably a four or five, and he can, you know, if not, he can do well in the bullpen. And it's like, okay, that's right. So the value, you know, if you compare WAR, you know, who knows? Jerrod Dyson is probably going to have a better season. He did last year than Nate Karns from a WAR perspective. But, you know, Karns didn't start. It wasn't a starting pitcher the whole season. You know, he had, let's see how many innings. He pitched 94.1 innings pitched. He only started 15 games out of his 22 appearances. So, you know, those things affect a pitcher's ability to kind of up that WAR number versus, you know, Jerrod Dyson, who was had a lot of extended playing time and it was platooning and, you know, got a lot of late inning replacements. He got a lot more opportunities. Now, you know, again, it still probably shakes out that Jerrod Dyson was more valuable last year. But point being, you know, the WAR statistics may not be exactly equal, but the two players might end up being, you know, more or less a wash. So
yeah.
I think that's the best you can hope for. So I don't feel like the Royals got ripped off. I didn't want them to make the trade. I don't think they should have made the trade, but I don't feel the same now as I did with the Will Myers trade at the time, and that turned out really well. So yeah. For whatever that's worth.
Yeah, and in, you know, just on the topic of WAR briefly, it's like, you know, I mean, now there's an opportunity for guys like Orlando and Terrence Gore and others to step up, and maybe they produce a similar amount of WAR just in, you know, that extra 50 plate appearances or those extra 10, 15 times pinch running for someone or anything like that. So, I mean, just because Dyson accumulated that on his own doesn't mean that these guys can't. So there's, you know, maybe you end up breaking about even with your bench, but, you know, you get this starter now. So, or maybe you don't. I mean, but I really figure that, you know, they feel confident enough in Orlando that they could probably get similar enough production that allowed them to make the move. And, you know, because otherwise it's a valuable player who's only going to cost you $2.5 million. There's no reason to trade him unless you really believe that you can A, make it up, and B, that what you're getting in return is going to be a value. And so I think they feel pretty confident in it. And the more I think about it, the more I'm like, yeah, I'm okay with it. I'm not like barreled over. I'm kind of like you. I'm just like, well, yeah, it's probably going to be fine. You know, there's nothing to gnash teeth over or take out full page ads or raise funds for a helicopter with a banner behind it to fly over Arrowhead on Sunday to yell about firing Glass or anything like that. There's nothing like that needs to happen. This is just a excess for a need. And really the Royals traded a pitcher for an outfielder and an outfielder for a pitcher. And you know, so maybe in the end Soler and Karns will have more value than Davis and Dyson. And if that's the case, then I think the Royals are not going to lose any sleep.
And again, we mentioned in both trades that they've saved some money from them. So if, and now you said, you know, they haven't really looked too active in the free agent market so far. So this could be the year that they actually say, we're going to save money and then actually save money. Hopefully not, but it could be now. But if they, you know, if they take that money and they go and they get one of the relievers that we mentioned previously, you know, Neftali Feliz, Sergio Romo, whoever,
Greg Holland,
you know, or sign a Jason Hamill, or, you know, who did we talk? Pedro Alvarez, right? We talked about him last week.
So Chris
last
Carter's week, still out there. Chris Carter, I mean, you know, like, so led the National League in homers last year and got released. Now, he strikes out a ton, but if the Royals just want to continue to add power, well, that would be a guy who could probably add some power to your lineup.
There you go. So, you know, it's, if the Royals take that money that they save and they parlay it into another player like that, then you say, okay, then you're not even looking at a player for player value. You're looking, okay, we got this, you know, $15 million or however much was promised to these two players, and now we've got three players instead, or four players even, if you can finagle that kind of a deal, and then turn that into, okay, well, these four players are definitely more valuable than these two players, and then you come out ahead. So, I mean, you kind of got to mix and match like that, unfortunately, a little bit with a deal like this, but it'll be interesting to see if they do anything else with that money. I really still think there's something coming. I think they're waiting a little bit longer to kind of see how everything shakes out and see who's left and all that kind of stuff. Cause I think one of the things Dayton Moore has publicly kicked himself for in the past is, you know, setting the market too fast, if you will, when you look at like Bruce Chinn type of a deal or something like that. So he's definitely learned from that. You know, he doesn't necessarily have to wait until, you know, spring training to get that done. But I do think something is still kind of, I'm not saying how big or how small it'll be, but something I think is coming.
Yeah. I mean, just in preparation for this, I jotted down like 20 some names of potential pitchers. And even like, you know, Santiago Casillas signed with Oakland today. Lewis Coleman was a guy I wrote down. He ended up signing with the Reds. Even if I eliminate like Scott Feldman and Doug Fister and Jason Hamill and Bud Norris, who probably want to start, that still leaves me with like 17 quality pitchers who the Royals could sign. You know, every other team could sign one of those guys, and there's still two left over. So I think that the market's going to end up providing some bargains that the Royals can either get these guys on maybe minor league deals or maybe pretty cheap 1 and 2 year deals. If they're looking for a reliever, and there are still guys out there who are, you know, going to be, you know, Chris Carter, Pedro Alvarez, you know, other hitters that could potentially end up signing if the Royals want to go that way. And again, you know, every day that we get closer to spring training, that's another day that the pressure kind of amps up on the free agent to find somewhere to actually land, because eventually, you know, teams won't have the roster flexibility. They won't have the spots open to maybe bring some of these guys in, and you know, so you, then you end up in a position where, you know, you really have to take whatever you can get at that point. So, you know, that might be something that the Royals can leverage to their advantage if they're looking to add one or maybe two more guys. And they could maybe even do that and still be spending less money than they anticipated going into the offseason. And that, you know, that could be a net gain for everybody. You know, you get a create some payroll or create some moves, add some players, and still save money. And, you know, if that results in some winning, well, that's a pretty solid offseason.
That's that Dayton Moore math. You know, you got to – that's what you got
to
do if
you
you're –
You have to massage
if
the roster.
Absolutely, you know, definite massaging
right.
going on. So, but I think with that, we've covered the trade as we've needed to cover it and other extraneous topics. So, you know, hopefully they'll keep this rolling. Hopefully they'll keep, you know, one trade a week until pitchers and catchers report. I'm okay with
Ooh,
that.
Boy.
We can make that happen.
They could probably pull it out. Maybe.
Yeah. I think you could do that without having to dip into any of the big guys like the Eric Hosmer and Moustakas of the world. They can make enough minor league trades and all that kind of stuff that we'd have enough to talk about. So, I mean,
Well, they did sign like three guys to minor league deals and invited them to spring training. So like Brandon League, who's had shoulder problems in the last couple of years, but has been a pretty good reliever when he's been healthy. So he's going to be in camp. Al Albuquerque, who we saw a billion times from the Tigers over the past few years, he'll be in camp. He didn't pitch, I think, pitched like twice for the Angels last year. And then Chris Withrow was another minor league signing. He was a former first-round pick in like 2007 and kind of a top prospect for a couple of years with the Dodgers, pitched last year with the Braves, and pitched okay for the Braves. He's had a lot of weird injuries. He cut his hand on a snorkel once. I looked it up.
Fun.
You know, like you do. But if he's healthy, you know, he's a guy who doesn't give up a lot of hits. He's kind of nasty in that way. So that could be intriguing as well. And then, you know, who knows who they bring in otherwise. So, I think they'll probably add a good chunk of other guys who they'll at least give tryouts to in spring training. And then if they sign a couple other guys to major league deals, well then awesome. You know, then the Royals may have something cooking It's, you know, after a really quiet offseason, they might pick it up here in the last few weeks before pitchers and catchers report.
Who knows? So with that, I think we will leave you on this evening or afternoon, morning, whenever you happen to be listening to our show. And if you are listening, thank you so much for doing so. We absolutely love all of our listeners. Couldn't do it without you guys. So thank you so much for listening. We're hoping for continuing on the more and more Royals news as we trudge through this off season. It's always tough to get to pitchers and catchers finally reporting, but we've made it to football playoff time. In a couple weeks, it's going to be the Super Bowl, and then it's all downhill from there. And, you know, hopefully we can be riding a Chiefs Super Bowl victory parade right into pitchers and catchers reporting.
Wouldn't that be something?
That would be something. You know, I don't know that I would participate in that parade after the Royals won. I don't know. Maybe it might be hard when it if it were to happen. This is a pipe dream, pie in the sky, the whole deal. But if it were to happen, I don't know if I could say no once I got that close to it, you know? Like, right. Oh, man, I really want to be down there. But at the same time, I don't know if I'd be like, man, I mean, people are ditching their cars on I-70. They're walking miles and miles. Do I want to go through this mess? I don't know.
Yeah. If the Royals win it again, I would not go to the parade.
If the Royals won it again, I definitely would not.
Yeah. The parade was pretty miserable.
But Chiefs,
but
little bit of a different story.
Yeah, on the other hand, you don't know when you're going to get back to it. So, maybe. I don't know. I almost skipped it that morning and still ended up going. And I actually caught heavy traffic, but the lighter part of heavy traffic. So it was like, all right. I didn't have the horror stories that other people had. I still didn't enjoy it. But, you know, it was an experience.
It was an absolute experience. It was different.
It was a thing that happened.
It was a thing that happened, and I was there, and you were there, and that was that. So, anyway, thank you all so much for listening. We'll continue talking about Royals the rest of this offseason. So continue to tune in. And another final congratulations to Hunter Samuels on his trip into fatherhood. It's a wonderful one. Congrats to you and your wife. Hunter. So, that'll be it. So, thank you all so much for listening. Be sure to visit our sponsors, bpkansascity.com. Obviously, great content, all that kind of stuff. And of course, Kelly.
I was going to say the Baseball Prospectus Annual is going to be coming out soon too. You can pre-order it on Amazon.
Yes, you can.
The comments for the Royals players were done by our own Craig Brown and Darren Watson and myself helped review some of those. I did not do much. Darren had already cleaned up most of it by the time I got in there. So really it's just Darren, but props to him. So you want to check that out. You can pre-order it on Amazon and you should be able to get it at any fine book retailer near you, independent or otherwise.
Indeed. So definitely be sure to check that out along with bpkansascity.com and of course Kelly's Westport Inn, who we couldn't be doing this for sure without them. So be sure to visit all of those wonderful things and purchase the BP annual.
You could get the BP annual. You could get it at the Barnes & Noble in the Plaza. I think there's still a Barnes & Noble in the Plaza in there.
There is.
And you could walk up to Westport and hang out at Kelly's Westport Inn. And enjoy a slice of pizza and have yourself a beer and read the annual and just hang out and have a good old time.
Damn it if that doesn't sound like a wonderful evening to me. So
I would still go to an indie bookstore myself, but that's just, you know, me.
Hey,
but
neither here.
I had to have the location.
Hey, if you place. You know what? Go to Half Price Books. I don't know if they have new books there. I don't know if they would get the BP annual.
I don't know if they'd get the BP annual or not.
But that's the closest local one I could think of to Kelly's Westport Inn. It's just right up the street. So you've got that.
Yes.
But anyway.
It's a good thing we stayed on topic through 100% of the show.
Hey, you know, that's what we do here.
Every single
day. Stay on topic. So thank you very much for listening. Please tune in next week. We'll have more Royals stuff to talk about. We will see you then. But until then, thanks for stopping by. And as always,
thank you for listening to the Kansas City Baseball Vault. You can follow us on Twitter at KC Baseball Vault. You can also find us on Baseball Prospectus Kansas City at bpkansascity.com. You can follow BPKC on Twitter at bprokansascity. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, through Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you like. And if you have any questions, comments, or if you just want to say hi, send those emails to kansascitybaseballvault@gmail.com.
Hey, Troy, what are you doing this weekend?
I'm going to grab a beer somewhere. What do you have in mind?
I heard about this awesome new bar downtown. It's called Rage. The waitresses have a contest to see who has the most piercing.
Oh, man, that's not really my scene.
Well, there's another bar close by called Spit Cup. Check it out. The bartenders wear chaps, and every hour they shoot a guy.
No, seriously, I just want a bar where I can sit down and watch the game.
Okay, I've got just the place. It's called Lilac. You sit on pillows, and you drink from eucalyptus leaves.
No, Ned, but I just want a place where I can get a cheap drink and watch the football game.
Okay, I got it. This place, it's got a TV. It's called 816.
Limitatosis.
Yep. All their drinks come in NBA hats.
Man, I just want a place like Kelly's.
Oh, you mean Kelly's Westport Inn? No, they've got all the basketball and bowl game. They've even got a heated roof. The view is really nice, too, if you know what I'm saying. Why didn't you just say you wanted to go to Kelly's?
Kelly's Westport Inn, 500 Westport Road. Make it your place to go any time of the week.